What's up, everybody? This is Healing Intentions, and I'm your host, Dr. Adrian Mimetti. This podcast is about natural health and wellness, mental health, cannabis, psychedelics, philosophy, and spirituality. Today, my guest is Sean Hardwick. Sean is a regulatory analyst at Mr. Cannabis Law. In the psychedelic industry, Sean drafted Florida HB 549-2021, which is Florida's first psychedelic legalization bill. With over 2 years in the regulated cannabis industry, he has drafted over 17 state marijuana license applications, business plans, and operating procedures for dispensary, cultivation, and manufacturing facilities in California, Illinois, Massachusetts, Missouri, New Jersey, and Utah. In the hemp industry, Sean assists clients to obtain hemp licenses and maintain compliance with federal and state regulations. Let's get started. All right. Welcome, everybody, to another episode of Healing Intentions. Today, I have a really special guest, somebody new in my life. He reached out to me and super excited that he did. And today I have on my show, Sean Hardwick. Welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
Awesome, man. Yeah, I saw that we have a lot of very similar interests and passions. And, you know, we were just talking before we hit record here. We both had a finance background in undergrad, and you know, I took the path towards medicine and natural medicine, and then you took the path, you know, towards law. But then we kind of end up in the similar spaces of cannabis and psychedelics. So it's like, wow, we were meant to meet and talk about our intersecting passions and how they all overlap and how we can help each other and help the greater cause for. You know, what we're trying to do here is just get people access to these awesome medicines and get their rights, you know, around them all figured out and yeah, just heal the world.
So yeah, yeah, absolutely, man. That's what it's all about.
Absolutely, bro. So yeah, want to start out, just give us a little bit of your background, kind of, you know, how did you end up in this cannabis space, and you know, and your kind of your brief background on you know, your career and how you got into law.
Yeah, so like you said, my degree in undergrad is in finance from the University of Central Florida. When I was there I did a couple of internships in real estate. Really thought that that's the route that I was going to go. When I came to law school, I thought I was going to do, you know, real estate law or real estate development in particular. And so everyone that I talked to, you know, in school wanted to do the same thing. And so I didn't want to compete against every single person in law school. So I kind of wanted to find my own niche. And so when I was doing that, my roommate and I kind of landed on white collar crime, and we founded the White Collar Crime Society at our law school. And so that's the route that I thought that I was going to go down, sort of white collar criminal defense. And so I had an internship lined up at the Broward County State Attorney's Office, and I was planning to do that. And then I saw a listing for a cannabis writer for a cannabis consultant in Boca Raton. So I applied for that, got that position. And so there, you know, we worked on a lot of marijuana licensing across the United States. And then I connected with my boss, Dustin Robinson, at Mr. Cannabis Law, where I am now. And joined his law firm. So now, you know, as part of the team, we're a full service cannabis and psychedelics law firm. So we work exclusively with companies in the cannabis and psychedelics industries, business formation, compliance, and mostly transaction based matters. Wow. So that's sort of how I ended up in this industry.
Wow, man. What an amazing story. And, you know, just briefly, give you a background, since we don't know each other, my story into naturopathic medicine is because of cannabis. I was in the cannabis industry in LA 6-7 years ago. I'd started a edible subscription box and, you know, went to the cannabis conference in Las Vegas, and I saw this naturopathic doctor speak, Dr. Michelle Sexton. I was like, whoa, what's this naturopathic medicine thing all about? And I had always wanted to be a doctor in my life, but I took the finance route kind of like last second in school, because I didn't want to be old. I didn't want to, you know, I wanted the money.
Oh, yeah.
And then I did finance and all these, you know, jobs and private equity, and I did sales after that. but I was never really passionate about it. You know, it was just about the money. And then I finally realized, like, wow, if cannabis is such a great herb and good for us, are there other good herbs out there? Oh, yeah. Yeah, there's a ton. And then it got me down the rabbit hole of, oh, the government's been lying about this really healthy plant. Have they been lying about other things too? Oh, and then you go down all these rabbit holes, and then here I am, you know, like I didn't touch cannabis till I was 26 years old. And I didn't touch psychedelics till I was 30, and I'm 34 now. So it's like, you know, it's, I have a different perspective on it all. And I'm fully in now, very passionate activist, you know, naturopathic doctor. And just, I really see the future of these as a part of our society and as being like the catalyst to shifting the whole paradigm.
Yeah, exactly. So what was your attitude, I guess, pre-26, before you started using cannabis? What was your attitude towards cannabis and, I guess, psychedelics?
Yeah, it was like everybody, you know, that doesn't know any better, non-educated. It's the stoners, man, people got to get high to like feel good. And like, you know, all my friends in high school would smoke except for me. So it
was, yeah, I was actually the same exact way.
Really?
Yeah.
Awesome. That's fascinating. You know, so it's like, I surprise people all the time because, you know, I'm like a clean cut guy and, you know, and I'm like, hey, like, yeah, I'm cannabis and psychedelics. And they're like, what? But I show up with like my suit and tie, you know, but it's like, it's changing the stigma of what this whole thing is about. And that's what changed my mind. I started working with these really smart guys. They had PhDs in chemistry and, you know, physics and all these things from Northwestern and in Chicago. And, you know, he said his professor is a Nobel Peace Prize winning chemist and has 2 ounces of, you know, cannabis in his office and smokes with students. And I was like, what? And that's awesome. I was like, oh, okay. So intellectual, like intelligent, successful people can do this too, huh? And then I started digging into it and I'm like, whoa, the more you dig into it, the more you realize like, wow, this is revolutionary. So that's my little background. And, you know, that's why I'm so into it now. And I just can't stop talking about it because people need to know the truth, man.
Yeah, no, I mean, especially now, I mean, the more people that I know now that consume cannabis are professionals, our moms and dads, grandparents, I to be honest with you, the amount of lazy stoners that I know is very little, very little. I think that, I mean, obviously the stigma stuck from the 1930s, but in reality, I think it's gone out the wayside.
It is, man. And, you know, I think that it's just the beginning. You know, it's still not federally legalized, which we'll get into that, I'm sure, plenty. Yeah. It's just the biggest hypocrisy, man. The government has a patent, as you well know, I'm sure, on cannabidiol, but they still classify it as a Schedule I drug.
Well, and Marinol, which is synthesized THC as well.
Yep, exactly.
So same exact thing.
Is a prescribable drug, but the plant, cannabis, not gonna happen. So that's quickly changing. Things are shifting so fast. I talk about, even these last few years, I said cannabis is really blowing up. I would be like the champion for cannabis through naturopathic medical school. Everybody knew me as like, oh, Adrian, the cannabis guy. Yes. You know, and I would like raise my hand and be like, well, actually, you know, there's some products out there that, you know, they use for menstrual cramps that are, you know, THC suppositories, and it's wonderful for women during their menstruation time. And it's like, the professor's like, wow, thanks for sharing, Adrian. Yeah. I just didn't care. I had no fear, you know, because I know what my intentions are for the healing.
Yeah, no, exactly.
And so yeah, man, I just get excited about cannabis has been doing this big shift. But then I was like, you know, psychedelics are kind of right behind it, when really now it's like they're neck and neck. And psychedelics, like MDMA, is most likely going to be, you know, scheduled as a pharmaceutical drug even before cannabis. Who knows? I mean, anything's possible, but, you know.
Yeah. Well, to your point, what's kind of funny is that psychedelics are in a weird way more legitimate than cannabis.
Right.
Because they are going through the FDA process, which is, you know, the correct, you know, federal process.
Right.
You know, and not that anyone hasn't wanted to do that for cannabis to get, you know, the proper research conducted to reschedule it, but you know, it being a Schedule I substance and being, you know, in Marinol, which is the synthesized THC, and CBD being in Epidiolex, you can't really study these compounds like you can psilocybin, MDMA, LSD, and all these other things. And they're already showing obviously tremendous benefits during their clinical trials.
Yeah, absolutely. It's just the beginning too. And those are the trials that have been done. That's not even considering all the thousands of anecdotal reports and the, you know, prior research in the 50s and 60s that they did in psychiatry. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's so much, and that's for, you know, that's just recent. What about the thousands of years of clinical, like just use, spiritual, medicinal, you know, sacred use of a lot of these psychedelics in since the beginning of human history for a lot of them, right? So it's like, you know, this is a lot more even beyond FDA and, you know, what the pharmaceuticals say and this and that. It's very interesting, the whole intersection between the spiritual, religious use, you know, personal use, medical use, like it's fascinating.
Yeah, no, it is fascinating. I mean, these substances have been used for thousands of years and they're well documented throughout history that they have, you know, spiritual, medicinal, therapeutic benefits. But the only problem is legislature, you know, lawmakers don't want to listen to anecdotal evidence. They want clinical evidence. They want raw data.
Right.
And the problem is, you know, everything being a Schedule I controlled substance, you know, puts the barriers on all of that. So, So as much as there is documented data throughout, you know, thousands of years, the only real data that we can present to lawmakers is, you know, within the last couple of decades, and it's, you know, it's so minimal, but the evidence that we do have is showing tremendous benefits over medicines that we are current that are currently used for those treatments.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Like PTSD, you know, with the studies they're doing with MAPS and MDMA. I mean, it's incredible. Treatment resistant PTSD, that the best that modern pharmaceutical and medicine had for these people, you know, was maybe 20% success rates, 30%. And then with MDMA, they're getting like 60% cured. I don't have PTSD anymore. That's a pretty big deal.
Well, yeah, I mean, and that's huge. I mean, especially in California, which has the most number of veterans suffering with PTSD, and then Florida, which is second most in the nation. Mm. I mean, these substances have the ability to benefit, you know, especially this pop, well, you know, a lot of people, but especially veterans who are a very vulnerable population, you know, who come back from overseas oftentimes with PTSD. So if these substances, you know, can help, I think, you know, and obviously you agree that they should be available for veterans to use. And what's really interesting about these two is that psychedelics are mostly like a one-time consumption event. So like people are using them one time to get over their PTSD or whatever ailment it is, you know, that they're trying to overcome. Whereas, you know, obviously opioids, we can go down the whole rabbit hole of how they're so much worse, but you know, you take 5 to 6 pills a day. You know what I mean? That's a completely different framework than what we're used to.
Oh man, big time different framework. And you know, 5-6 pills a day for how long? For the rest of your life? Like when is this going to end? You know, are you a pro? It's horrible to say, and it's crazy in some people's minds. But when I see that, I see, well, that's a super profitable, you know, that's a nice profit center right there.
Yeah,
it's somebody's health you're talking about. That's the problem. That's the problem with the paradigm and the system we're in, is that it's, you know, profit driven, and a cured patient isn't super profitable now, is it?
Exactly.
And so that's why the whole paradigm needs to and will change, I believe, because it's just not working the way it is. And I think a lot of people are realizing that too, you know, every day. Everybody I talk to out here in California, it's one of the reasons why I'm out here. You know, the consciousness is just like, people are like, yeah, this is pretty much everybody I talk to every day. I was just in the gym this morning, guy in the sauna. I'm like, yeah, I'm a naturopathic doctor. I'm into cannabis, psychedelics, you know, mental health. And He's like, oh, me too, man. It's changed my life. I'm like, there you go. Perfect. Yet another person that I met that supports this. It's just incredible, man. It's really cool to see.
Yeah. And but again, what's really frustrating about this is that you and I meet so many people where these substances help them. But again, lawmakers don't want to listen to these right. individual stories.
Yep.
They want to listen to clinical data. So that's the paradigm that we're at.
Yeah, no. And it's pretty cool to see. I've seen some pretty exciting things. Have you heard of like the Noetic Fund? It's a fund that's been put together of it's like a private equity fund investing in psychedelic companies. You should definitely check it out. Yeah. And go ahead.
I'm sorry. I was going to say, my boss, Dustin Robinson, does actually the same exact thing. He has a fund called Eater Investments.
Oh,
which,
wow.
Which invests in, first round psychedelic companies.
Beautiful, man. Beautiful. So that, yeah, when I saw that was happening, I was like, okay, this is a big deal. There's a lot of money already supporting this, as we've seen, you know, from Tim Ferriss being involved and NYU and Johns Hopkins and all these big, centers with a lot of money. I think it was like $17 million at Johns Hopkins, got put into the psychedelic research center. I mean, that's big time, and it's just the beginning, but that's what's needed, you know?
Yeah. And I mean, even go back to our finance, Mr. Wonderful, from Shark Tank, he's very bullish on psychedelics,
yes,
which I think brings this whole new layer of legitimacy to the industry on top of the fact that they are going through the FDA process.
Yeah.
The more formalized process.
Just like this book right here, Michael Pollan, How to Change Your Mind. Him writing this book is a big, big deal. He's a very well-respected, big time author. And for him to write this and to experience some of them himself is awesome. And I just read his other book that's new, This Is Your Mind on Plants. And he talks about opium, mescaline, and coffee and tea. And it was a really interesting book, really dives deep into the whole opioid rabbit hole. And man, that's such a messed up rabbit hole. I don't even want to go there, but like, it's one of my reasons that fuels me every single day when I think about that stuff. And, over 110 overdose deaths a day from opioids a day.
Yeah.
In this country, and back to the veterans, it's like 20 veterans, I think, a day commit suicide. And that's unacceptable. And
yeah, it's unfortunate.
And we have a lot of solutions for it, and I'm here to fight and be that warrior for, every single person out there that needs and deserves that because it's what's right. And the system, and that's why people are doing it, regardless of the law or not, right? There's law, and then there's the enforcement of the law, and then there's the the whole underground part of the economy. And it's just so fascinating. Out here in California, let me tell you, I've already met 3 people that are making psilocybin mushroom chocolate bars.
No, I believe it.
Oh, it's decriminalized. Oh, it's going to be decriminalized. Oh, whatever. That doesn't mean anything. You can't be doing that as a business legally.
Yeah, no, you can't. But
it doesn't stop people.
That definitely doesn't stop anyone.
So it's very interesting. But what's your perspective on how cannabis has kind of been commercialized and, risen these last few years big time, and how psychedelics are similar, how they're going to be different? Like, what's your take on all of that? I know there's so much there.
Yeah. So I think that the psychedelics framework is going to look completely different than cannabis.
Yeah.
Obviously, with cannabis, there's 2 different models. For marijuana, you have the medical marijuana, you have your qualifying condition, you get your card, and then you go to the dispensary, get your product, come home and consume it. Recreational, anyone who's over 21 purchases the product, comes home and consumes it. And, obviously public consumption is pretty much illegal everywhere.
Right.
For a psychedelics framework, I think it's mainly going to be medical, but it's not going to be kind of done in the same way. So you're probably going to need a qualifying condition, you know, such as PTSD or something like that. Mm-hmm. And then the substances will only be taken in a medical clinic. So like you'll go to like either a doctor's office or a hospital or some sort of medical licensed medical clinic. And under the supervision of medical professionals, you'll take your psilocybin, MDMA, or whatever the case may be. So you always have somebody kind of monitoring you to make sure that, you know, all of your vitals and everything, you know, remain the way that they should be, because it is, you know, obviously a psychoactive and a much more intense experience than cannabis. Mm-hmm. And, you know, again, because they are, you know, much more psychoactive, a lot more potent, it's going to be a lot more controlled than cannabis. You can't just sell somebody mushrooms and let them take them home, pretty much. Mm-hmm. I do think, though, the closest thing that we will get to a sort of recreational market where you could potentially take products home is with the development of microdosing products. So if there could be some sort of regulatory framework where, you know, psilocybin, MDMA, whatever the case may be, you know, could be concentrated in such low doses, you know, and sold, and can be tracked in kind of a similar way to cannabis, whereas you have like a certain purchase limit and whatnot. I could see microdose products, you know, potentially being sold, but as far as most psychedelic substances, you'll probably have to consume them in some sort of, healthcare facility.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wow. You just mentioned a lot of things there that I want to talk about, but yeah, microdosing is very interesting because there's, once again, it's one of those things. There's like really not that much research about it, like at all, you know, it's very limited. And so it's a lot of anecdotal things. There's, you know, Dr. James Fadiman and Dr. Paul Stamets, that talk about it a lot, and, you know, other people, of course, but it's one of those things that, a lot of people, though, I like it for a lot of people, though, because it's a nice introduction into that whole realm instead of, you know, like how I started and how a lot of people start. Well, here's your whole eighth of mushrooms and enjoy, you know, go for the ride. And I was just like, whoa, you know, and that can be great. Also, you know, there's the micro and then the macro dose, and depending on where you are and your intention. But like I said, I knew I wasn't ready for that until I was 30 years old. I did so much research. I watched so many documentaries, read books, talked to people before I ever took any psychedelic, you know? And then once I did, I was like, okay, yeah, I see what's going on here. I'm diving head first, and never really came out of that rabbit hole. Still, I'm still in it.
Yeah. I seem to notice that everyone who's really passionate about psychedelics is always skeptical at first, and then does a ton of research, and then realizes that, you know, it's a good substance, something that's worth trying, takes it, and then it's like life changing. And, you know, and then you're like, now you're on a mission to, you know, change the world.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, and I want to just say, I want to preface, like, it's not for everybody. We're not like recommending it. It's definitely very intense. You got to be ready for it. You got to be you know, have a calling for it. And it's just a tool. It doesn't do the work for you. It shows you what's possible. I love the analogy of like doing the work on your own is possible also through meditation and breath work and yoga and therapy and all these different things, right? Mm-hmm. And that's like walking up the mountain one step at a time. Psychedelics are like a helicopter ride to the top. They're like, yo, this is what's possible up there. Now go back down and do that, you know? So that's kind of how I see them. Would you agree with that analogy generally?
Yeah, no, absolutely. You know, obviously psychedelics are very hard to put into words, but
right.
Ineffable, as they say. Exactly. How I would describe it, I think it puts me into like a different realm. I think there's almost this sort of like fourth dimension that a lot of people don't realize is kind of around us. I call it the spirit realm because I'm a Christian, but I think there's like this fourth dimension around us. And, but it definitely allows you to get insights that you could not get otherwise. but it can go, you know, obviously in a good way or it could go in a bad way. And it's a very intense situation. Mm-hmm. And so you're right. It is not for everyone. It's only for people who have the right setting, the right intention. You have to know why you're taking the substance. Yep. You have to do it in the right location. Yep. You have to have the right mind frame. It's not a party drug. This is a hardcore substance, but used in the right way, it's a medicine and it's a tool.
Yeah.
So, I think with all of that put together, you know, when used properly, I think you'll have an experience that you'll never forget. And every person I've spoken to about it, you know, 99% of the stories that I've heard have been absolutely nothing but fantastic, you know, life-changing in a positive way. There's only one story that I can recall off the top of my head that was, you know, a negative sort of experience that deterred them from psychedelic use forever. But that was only one. And, you know, after talking with them and all the circumstances surrounding it, I could see why that happened, because they didn't have the right mind frame. They weren't in the right location. Pretty much everything that you need to do involving psychedelics was sort of wrong. Mm-hmm. And so, I think everyone needs to like sort of keep in mind that something could go wrong. Obviously everyone needs to keep that in mind, but again, 99% of stories that I've heard in my personal experiences, everything has been positive if done correctly and safely.
Yeah. Yeah, I would agree. And I have one, circumstance I can think of when I was, you know, witness the time when somebody that had some underlying mental illness going on, and mm-hmm. you know, it was like under the surface kind of, but then it kind of came out, but it ended up being a good thing, I think, because it was able to be better treated and like diagnosed, and like really like it was like a big turning point and awakening, I think, from there, mm-hmm. from what I understand. So it ended up, you know, that's the whole idea of like there is no bad trip. It could be difficult, mm-hmm. but that doesn't mean it's bad to label it that judgment. You know, there could be a lot that you get out of it when you had this horrible, oh my God, oh, I thought about death and dying and oh, my whole family dying, all this terrible shit. I hated it. Well, it was like, well, why did that come up?
Yeah.
You know, it's a psychedelic literally means mind manifesting, you know, bringing your subconscious to the conscious. And that's powerful. A lot of stuff is down there in that subconscious.
Absolutely. But I think it's interesting that you brought up death as being like the negative, because what I've experienced is that most people have some sort of encounter with death during their psychedelic experience. And it's actually a positive thing.
Right.
Like I know through my psychedelic experience with psilocybin mushrooms that I fear death a lot less, because there is really nothing to fear.
Yep.
And, you know, I'm not saying you completely necessarily agree 100%, but I'm sure your perception of that has changed as well.
Oh yeah. No, I was saying it in the context of like, you know, a lot of people have that fear of death, and mm-hmm. it's something that could very well come up. And like you said, often does, pretty much always can, depending on what you're doing, right? Like the very stronger doses and like ayahuasca and like things like that. Like that's, you know, that's the realm you're in. I mean, ayahuasca is literally the vine of the dead, you know, so definitely. But it's that fear in general, just the concept of fear that comes up a lot. And like, what is fear really, you know? And it's just like that one acronym, false evidence appearing real. That's what fear is, you know? And it's like,
oh, I've never heard that.
Yeah, it's a good one, right? And, you know, and like somebody else said, it's like philosophically, there's really only two emotions, love and fear.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, you know, just, you can't be afraid and just go back to your heart and love, you know, get out of our minds and get it back into our hearts. And that's what psychedelics can pretty much force you to do and be in the present moment. And it can be damn uncomfortable, but it could be exactly what you need to see in that moment.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, and you can experience a death of your ego. And I mean, mm-hmm. it's fascinating that physiologically with the fMRIs and the parts of, you know, they do the studies of people on psychedelics and the default mode network part of our brain that's shut down when we're on psychedelics. That's literally our ego. It's different parts mm-hmm. of our brain that like make up our ego and our like normal consciousness. And it's very powerful when you can temporarily lower that for a bit, what can come out and what you can experience and what you can learn and how you can shift. You know, it's not about what you do or have, it's who you become, who you are, who you be as a person.
Yeah, exactly. And what I've noticed too is I think that obviously as you're going through your experience, your brain sort of shuts down all of the thoughts that go on constantly throughout your day.
Yep.
So, you know, as you're, you know, sitting, doing your work or in traffic or whatever the case is, your brain is just constantly making thoughts, random thought here, random thought there, random thought here, random thought there.
Yep.
And that can really take a toll on you. And so what I think one of the greatest things that I like about, you know, psilocybin in particular is that it kind of shuts that down, at least for, you know, at least for a little bit. And you're just in this total peaceful zone where you're not bombarded by these thoughts. And it's during that time, you kind of realize like how much of your brain is focused on, you know, what other people think about you or politics or things going on around you that just don't matter, that are constantly just taking away the energy of your brain, which ultimately like depletes your energy and depletes your happiness. And, you know, at least, you know, psilocybin gives you at least a momentary, it's almost like a forced like meditation. It's like meditation on like, you know, up to the extreme, but it does last for longer than like the 8 hour, you know, high that is associated with psilocybin. But you're left with that zen of, you know, a clear mind that, you know, you don't have to worry about what people think or just all these other sorts of things that we deal with every single day in our brain.
Yeah, man. Wow. Well said. And, you know, you mentioned something about meditation and that's literally what I would say. I've done a 10-day silent meditation retreat, the Vipassana meditation. I highly recommend anybody check them out. They're great. They provide the lodging.
That sounds amazing.
Yeah, it's awesome. And they provide the food, everything, and it's all donation based. Mm-hmm. It's free.
Mm-hmm.
And they have centers all over the world. Incredible, incredible. Check them out. And I did that before I'd ever done any psychedelics. And that was wow. After I do psychedelics, after I realized, okay, definitely you can get to these states of mind 100% through meditation. It takes practice. It takes work. It takes dedication.
It's a lot of work.
Yep. And they've done studies of people that are long-term meditators, 20, 30 years long, hour plus a day meditators, you know, very intense. And they analyze their parts of the brain, the fMRI. Same parts of their brain are lit up as when you're on mushrooms. Same exact parts. Default mode network once again. And it's like, oh wow, there's a big link between mushrooms meditation. There's a great book I recommend, Zigzag Zen. It's all about Buddhism and psychedelics, and man, they go deep. You know, a lot of these Buddhist masters and people, like, they started off with psychedelics. They got the message and then they hung up the phone, you know, as Alan Watts would say, and then they just continued on their journey with the meditating, breath work, whatever stuff. But like, you know, and some continue using it and say, no, it's a big part of my practice and whatever. So it's just really cool, man. It's really cool. I'm like 4 or 5 years new into this all. There's people that have been doing this their whole lives.
Oh yeah. There's OGs out there.
Yeah. Yeah. So I want to ask you about some more details about like the law, like cannabis law going on. What's your take on everything, you know, with it getting, like, is it better to get federally like legalized? Is it better to be descheduled? Is it better to be lowered on the schedule? Like, what's your take on that? What would be the best way going forward, or the, you know, for the greater good?
Yeah, I mean, it's very interesting. There's, you know, there's a lot of different things that can be done. There's, you know, there's a few bills that are introduced into Congress, and to be honest, I don't really see any of them really gaining any sort of traction. I just think there's way too much disconnect. You know, you kind of have your House and Senate Republicans who don't really support it, and then you have your House and Senate Democrats that typically do. But I'm kind of seeing that I don't really think the president and vice president really support it. So I just don't really see this kind of, you know, gaining any real traction. But I don't know. I think we're going to be dealing with this sort of state, each state kind of having its own industry for a while. I think one of the biggest or one of the easiest fixes is to allow these companies to have access to banking resources.
Yes.
So that's one of the bills that's actually gained the most traction.
Yep.
And that has the most likely chance of passing, just because all you're basically doing is giving these companies access to banking.
Yeah.
You're not legalizing or anything, but what that would do is, you know, give operators, you know, a place to put their money, give them a chance to get loans like a normal business. Because right now you basically need to have all the money you need to operate up front. So if you have a mom or pop who really wants to open a dispensary, and if you can do it in, you know, in the state, depending on your framework, it's really hard because you're most likely going to need $500,000 plus just to, you know, get the real estate, equipment, inventory, your employees, insurance, you know, legal fees and this and that. And so, that's, you know, that's really hard for a lot of people to just, you know, pull that money, you know, and just say, you know, we'll invest all of this right now into this business, which is not guaranteed to work.
Right.
So, you know, I think having access to banking, you know, not only makes the cannabis industry more legitimate, but it is an easy way to help operators, you know, all across the country.
Let me just say one thing about that. I totally agree. And, you know, I remember going to the cannabis conference, the you know, MJ Biz Daily, you know, the big cannabis conference in Las Vegas. Which will you be at that, by the way? I'm going in October.
No, I won't.
Okay. But
I'll make it out there. I haven't been yet, but that's definitely like on the bucket list.
Okay, cool. Yeah, I'll be there, and then I'll be at EDC Las Vegas for my birthday, which is that weekend.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, so I'm super excited. But yeah, I remember at that conference, they said back in like 2014, 15, they said that 80% of the cannabis industry, which is how many billion now? I don't even know. I haven't caught up with recent numbers. Like,
yeah, it's
legal.
Like 25 or 30.
Yeah. All of that, like 80% back then was in cash in dollar bills. Like, that's crazy. You know, they'd be dropping off their tax payments and stuff like in duffel bags at the courthouse.
Yeah.
Like, you know, it shouldn't have to be that way, you know, and like going to an industrial area, like you're doing some kind of like, you know, mafia deal or something, like,
yeah.
What are we buying here? Nuclear weapons or like a plant? Like, it's just so crazy.
Yeah, no, exactly. I'm not sure how it is in California, but I know in Florida, pretty much every dispensary here takes CanPay, which is basically you just connect your bank account to this like third party app, and then you can facilitate the payments through that. It's basically just kind of like Venmo or whatever.
Wow.
You're just connecting your bank account. And so you can do like your debit payments that way.
I've never heard of that even. No, we don't have that here. And everybody does. A lot of places are cash only still.
Really?
The recreational. Yeah. And then it's all recreational, you know, here now, except some cities are medical only still.
Mm-hmm.
And then some places take debit card, and I don't know how they do that through whatever ATM merchant systems, whatever, but you know, $3 fee or whatever, and take your debit card, put in your PIN, and no problem, sir. And yeah. And that's, I don't know how legit that is fully or whatever, but, you know, it's the wild west out here.
Yeah. But it's interesting to see how like creative people can get working around all of these sort of prohibitions against cannabis.
Yeah.
Because again, I mean, now we're having these, you know, third party payment processors come in, to facilitate these transactions because not everyone carries around cash. So
absolutely. Yeah. A lot of people don't these days, especially the younger, you know, millennial generation. It's just like, we the only time I go to get cash is when I need to go to the dispensary. I mean, that's just how it is. But what's your take on, I don't know how much you're into all the cryptocurrency blockchain, you know, stuff going on and like the law behind all of that, that is ever evolving as well. And I think there's a lot of very interesting intersections between all this stuff we just talked about and that, like, you know, what do you have to say about that?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not like a big expert on cryptocurrency or anything like that. I personally don't even invest in any.
Okay.
I don't really understand it as far as I'm kind of like, I'm not as extreme as Warren Buffett towards I don't agree with it at all.
Right.
I think there's just way too many cryptocurrencies now. Like, you know, like there's obviously a lot of legitimacy around Bitcoin, Ethereum.
Right.
And a couple other ones, but like, there's absolutely no reason why Dogecoin should be a thing. If I fit it at least. So we can go back and forth with that. But as far as an interaction between not necessarily a cryptocurrency, but I actually wrote a paper about hemp being tracked on a national blockchain ledger. Because, you know, hemp is federally legal. Hemp products can be created in Florida, you know, sold to a processor in Colorado, and then sold to an end user in North Carolina.
Yep.
And if that, you know, that end user in North Carolina gets sick or for whatever reason, good luck tracing back to that original Florida, you know, hemp operator. So, you know, obviously a blockchain is really efficient at storing information. That information can't be altered, and you can trace the record back to its original owner. So for every single hemp product that's created in the United States, we can have a record of who grew the product, who created it, who transported it, who sold it, and then ultimately who purchased it. And then if there's any sort of problem in that sort of supply chain, we can, you know, see exactly who who caused the problem and hold that person, you know, accountable, or, you know, resolve any sort of issue that there might be.
Wow. That's huge, man. That's huge what you just said. If people listening can just wrap their head around what you just said, rewind it, re-listen to it, or whatever you need, because man, the implications of that, I mean, you know, from studying finance and economics, like, the deal is with the cryptocurrency side, money and the way we do money has never been innovated since the beginning of human history. It's happening right now. Mm-hmm. Like, I met a 26-year-old guy. I was like, what do you do, man? He's like, I'm retired. I'm like, what do you mean? He's like, oh, I'm in smart contracts. I'm like, oh, okay, I know what you mean. And you know, he's a multi-millionaire because of cryptocurrency. Yeah. And there's going to be a whole lot more of that coming, you know, and I think it's just going to revolutionize everything with the way we're doing a whole bunch of different things. And man, I just think with hemp at a very minimum, wow, you know, the power of hemp as a plant and all it can do way beyond just CBD, you know, what hemp can do for paper and plastic and fuel and, you know, energy. And all of these different things that it can do, and building, you know, all these things like construction, like it's really revolutionary. And there's a reason.
That's really what I'm most excited about as far as hemp goes, because, you know, again, it's a regenerable plant. It's all natural and it works a lot more effectively in commercial products. Like you said, paper, rope, building supplies, etc., than a lot of traditional materials. And but the problem is, like, everyone who's in the hemp industry now is focused on selling cannabinoid products. So they're only interested in selling CBD or Delta 8 THC or some sort of other minor cannabinoid product.
Yeah.
And no one's interested in really developing hemp plastic or hemp paper or hemp rope, because it's not sexy and it's not it's probably not the most profitable. But that's definitely where I think the country needs to be moving. And I honestly think we're not really going to see that development or that shift towards all natural sort of hemp products until we start seeing true investments from either state or federal government into, you know, those resources.
It could be state or federal government. I agree. It's got to be something. Could be state or our federal government, or it could come from private. Like the,
yeah, the only reason I don't say private is, again, because it's just not that profitable.
Right.
And so the reason you would be doing it is obviously for the, you know, obviously more for the public benefit.
Right.
And so that's why I don't. Well, I think once, you know, once it's scaled up to a certain degree, it could be profitable. So that's why I really think that you need that sort of initial investment from either the state or national government. And
yeah,
that's
yeah,
why I think it's going that way. Yeah,
I could see that. Yeah, definitely. You know, I was just thinking of somebody like Elon Musk or, you know, Jeff Bezos, like with space and, you know, NASA and all the stuff that they're doing. It's just like, and Richard Branson, you know, it's just like, wow, you know, what's possible. And that's just with space and with like electric cars. Like, imagine if that focus was placed towards all this stuff we're talking about, man. I mean, that's revolutionary, you know. That's kind of my big vision, is changing this whole paradigm. And just like how it happened in the past, it took a lot of money and power. We can get that money and power and do it for the good, like you said, the greater good, and make money out of it, you know. People and profit and the planet, the three P's, right? Like, that's what it's all about. So I think it's possible, man. I think it takes people like you and I and, you know, many others, and, you know, getting us all enrolled in this vision. And I really see that tipping point, you know, kind of coming. It's not everybody. It's not 100% of the world. It's like, you know, 10% or so. And then it just, that ripple effect.
Yeah. And the thing is, it will never be 100% of the world. I mean, not everybody likes alcohol. Not everybody likes, you know, certain things. Like, nobody's, you know, you're never going to get 100% of the people, but what you and I are passionate about is making sure that the people who want access to these substances, who have done their research and can take it safely, have access to these substances. Yep. We're not trying to push these on anybody.
No.
We just want to make sure that everybody who wants them and can take them safely and responsibly can do so. And that's it.
Yep. And then, you know, sounds like you have a passion for, you know, the law side of it, and you can get more deep into that, you know, how exactly you want to be involved in the future of it all, how you see yourself, you know, getting into it. I guess that's a question, you know, I want to start with.
Yeah. So last legislative session for Florida, we drafted and introduced Florida's first bill for psilocybin legalization. It didn't make any traction, but basically we looked at basically Oregon's framework and sort of made some changes to it. But basically licensed producers would create the psilocybin products. You would take the psilocybin product at the licensed health facility, like I was talking about earlier. You would meet with a medical professional to determine if, you know, if taking psilocybin is appropriate for your medical condition. And then you go through, you know, pre-counseling. And then once you take it, there'll be a medical professional who advises you the whole time. And then you have, you know, transportation home, and then post-treatment sort of counseling. And then we also included a decriminalization measure in there for all entheogenic substances. But obviously, like I said, that didn't really gain any traction. We didn't really expect it to. It was kind of a Hail Mary sort of, you know, bill. But what it did is it got the conversation started in the Florida legislature that, you know, psychedelic substances are legitimate, and there's an industry to be made around it. You know, whether it's you know, like the medical framework that we did, or some sort of other framework. And so for this upcoming legislative session, we're drafting a research bill, which would require the Department of Health to essentially write a report on the efficacy of psychedelic substances, and, you know, make any sort of legislative or recommendations for any sort of legislative change with regards to psychedelics. And especially with regards to PTSD, because again, our focus down here is treating veterans. And like we said, California has the most, Florida has the second most in the nation. So this is a real issue that, you know, we think can be solved in part through psychedelics. And we're just simply asking the state to conduct some research into determining if that's the case. So if that passes, hopefully that'll be a good first step to, you know, make a legitimate argument for creating the more, you know, medical based framework that I was talking about earlier. So, yeah.
Awesome. Awesome. Wow. That's really cool. Appreciate that. All that work that you just said that you're involved with, man, that's really great. And, you know, like you said, it didn't get a lot of traction, but you know, that's definitely not something you expected to happen overnight, and you planted the seed and now it's about watering it, you know, over time and making sure there's some good nutrients and, you know, the whole thing. And, exactly. pretty soon, next thing you know, you'll have a beautiful, you know, maybe we can get all of the politicians, you know, somehow,
a group, you know, trip together,
microdosed, or you know, some kind of you know, not Timothy Leary style in the water, like not like that, people. But you know, I think it could be it's gonna be great. I really think within like 5 or 10 years, a lot of things are gonna be very different. You know, I really see like a new earth. You know, Eckhart Tolle, it's a great book, that's coming around the corner. Like you said, 4D. that you get into, you know, a lot of the spiritual, you know, community talks about like 5D consciousness, you know, and that's kind of like what we're transitioning to. And that's kind of like what's happening right now and why it's so hard for a lot of people. And it's like, well, where are you at in that, you know, progression of your, you know, soul or spirit or however you want to look at it, consciousness. And so, you know, but I think what's right around the corner is going to be beautiful, however your views of it are, you know. Yeah. I was curious, in that decrim bill that you guys wrote, did you exclude peyote cactus, or was it in there?
Yeah, no, it was all entheogenic substances, so that's any naturally occurring substance or any naturally occurring psychedelic substance. So peyote would be included in that.
Okay. Yeah. Cause it's probably, I don't know how is common it is in Florida grown, but, in California, they took it out because a lot of the, you know, tribes will said, well, that's a big part of our, you know, like, you know, spirituality and what we do. And if there's, you know, people coming all over trying to, you know, harvest and whatever, they can really mess with things and whatever. So they actually took peyote out, I believe, in California in the decrim bill. The decrim nature or whatever. I think, you know, I can't keep up with, there's so many things.
There's going so many on. Different organizations.
Yeah, with so many states and so many, but I know that, and I was reading in the Michael Pollan book until they talked about how they fought to like take it out here. So that was quite interesting. I don't have any experience with that personally, but I'm definitely intrigued and love the whole tradition and culture around so many of the great, you know, Native American tribes that we have in our country here. That's just, I love that whole world. I don't know much about it, but I have some friends that we're doing like shaman training, and you know, we're kind of deep in that world. So it's pretty cool stuff.
Oh, that sounds sick.
yeah, definitely. So what else, Sean, what else is on your mind that you want to talk to the world about that's going on, or that, you know, you had on your heart or on your mind?
Well, it's just exciting. Well, not exciting or interesting to see the development of minor cannabinoids that we're seeing in hemp. We're getting bombarded, you know, with inquiries to get legal opinions on Delta 10 THC, HHC, THCV, THCP, THCO. So there's all these sort of, you know, new hemp products that are coming out. So I think the hemp industry is sort of gonna you know, have some spotlight in the next few months as these new compounds come out, especially after all the hype around Delta 8 THC that we saw, you know, earlier this year and last year. Mm-hmm. So I think that'll be interesting to see.
Man, that's funny you mention, because I have a good friend. He was just on the podcast a couple episodes ago, Dr. Kareem Candeel. He's an MD and an ND like me, and he is really passionate about minor cannabinoids. He's mm-hmm. always sending me, like, every other day, he's like, dude, check this one out. I'm like, wow, like, when does this end? Like, yeah. it literally, I'm honestly going to look it up right now, because he's so into it that I have to tell you, because he mentioned some that I've never heard of before, man. And I was like, THCV, great, because appetite, mm-hmm. you know, suppressant, which is mm-hmm. massive in cannabis. That's one of the big problems that people can't stop eating. and so he sent me one, Delta 6A 10A THC, aka Delta 3. Grown from hemp. I'm like, dude, this is getting out of control. But mm-hmm. yeah, I can understand that. They're like doing what they have to do, man. Hey, okay, we yeah. can't do this the same as whatever. Okay, look, we can make all these other cannabinoids.
Yeah, well cannabis contains, you know, over 150 cannabinoids naturally,
right?
And you know what's gotten all the spotlight is Delta 9 THC, which right. is obviously the cannabinoid that gets you high, and then yep. CBD.
Yeah.
And then cannabis is completely classified by its the amount of Delta 9 THC that's contained in it.
Right.
So any cannabis with more than 0.3% THC or more is marijuana, and it's federally illegal. And anything, you know, 0.3% or less is federally legal and is considered hemp. And so all these hemp operators are basically just trying to sort of work around that and say, well, we can create a sort of, you know, other cannabinoid product that will contain less than 0.3% Delta 9 THC, but it will contain 80-90% of another cannabinoid that also happens to potentially get you high or have some sort of, you know, psychoactive effect. But I think it's really the chase is that there's, you know, 150 of them, and there's really only two of the cannabinoids that are really widely known. Yep. Obviously there's, I mean, CBN and Delta 8 THC, there's a little bit more knowledge on, you're going to have a few more people who have heard of it and have used it. But once you start getting the THCVs, THCPs, THCOs, it's like, you know, and then, and what else has to be explored? You know, what hasn't been discovered yet? What's going to be the next product? And so it's really going to be interesting to see how the DEA and state regulators regulate these products, especially as a lot of the newer cannabinoids, in particular HHC, THCO, and THCP, are very psychoactive. THCP can have upwards of, it has 33 times the affinity to CB1 receptors as THC.
Wow.
So I guess in theory, it could be up to 3,200% more psychoactive than THC, theoretically. Now, it's not necessarily going to play out that way. It's not necessarily going to be 3,200% more psychoactive, but the fact that it binds 33 times more than traditional THC, there's definitely an increased psychoactive effect that you will feel. So even if it is, you know, hemp-derived product, it's going to be interesting to see how the DEA and the state regulators enforce these regulations with these operators selling these products, especially if minors get their hands on these products.
Yeah, no, that is going to be interesting. I mean, can't you see it being where they just make a law where it's like all other minor cannabinoids are, you know, not allowed or whatever, like just blanket, like anything, you know, like, or is that, that's not that easy. That's why it's the way we're.
I don't think it's that easy. And then on top of it, there's just way too much backlash from the hemp industry. There's already way too many products that it would just shut down an entire industry. And so It's basically regulators trying to catch up to hemp operators who are just being very creative.
Yeah. And I saw this other company that makes, they're doing CBD, of course, they've been doing, now they do Delta 8, and then they do CBG, and then CBN, and then CBC, which is pretty rare. And you can buy all those separately, and then they also sell blends. And then some like that's, and they're very high quality, you know, organic New Leaf Naturals. If you've ever heard of them, they're really, really good quality.
Yeah, I believe I have.
And yeah, so they're one of the good ones I like out there, but you know, many others. And so it's cool. It's interesting to see. And therapeutically, we see when you combine a lot of those, some really cool stuff can happen, especially the acidic forms of it, like CBDA or THCA. That in therapy, I read this book, Cannabis is Medicine by Dr. Bonnie Goldstein. Mind-blowing. She uses it a lot in you know, clinical practice, and it's just like unbelievable the effect she gets from just layering different things, because that's what, you know. And but then it's not that shocking to me from a holistic medicine point of view. It's like we're always looking at the whole, you know, the whole plant. There's over 150 cannabinoids, and there's over 400 different constituents, you know, the phytonutrients and the terpenes and the all the different stuff going on, and how that all interacts and synergizes, plus how that interacts with your body, which is a living system, and your endocannabinoid system is based, you know, affected on so many things affect it, your microbiome, you know, and your sleep and your exercise and all of your diet, all this stuff that if you, that's all really out of line, you taking 5 milligrams of something is going to be completely a different effect than somebody who's way closer to balance, takes 5 milligrams, like, oh, I can really feel this, you know, and it really makes sense. So I've seen that in people that have like impaired digestive systems, like something wrong with, you can eat whatever you want, right? But is your body absorbing it, you know? And that's key with digestion. And you could, I've seen people that have impaired digestion or like liver function, they take edibles, you know, and they barely feel anything. And I'm like, okay, that's obviously saying something, you know?
Yeah. I've heard that a lot, actually.
Yeah. So that's something that a lot of people have issues with, you know, gut issues. And, you know, a lot of people, you know, our society, the modern day in America, wreaks havoc on our liver. If you drink, if you eat any meat, any processed foods, any, all that stuff, it's gonna, you know, make it work hard, a lot harder than it should. And then all the toxins, it's got to detox, and, you know, our livers do a lot for us, so they definitely get overworked. And yeah, man. So yeah, well, it's been really great having you, and definitely lots more to talk about, but, you know, we'll keep it short and sweet, and you know, we'll definitely connect in the future. I appreciate having you, and yeah, man, thanks again.
Yeah, of course, thanks for having me. It was a blast.
Awesome, bro.